Good morning. The next matter on our oral calendar is State of Minnesota versus Crystal Olson. Council, as you're getting squared away, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument, and we'll have an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. We are keeping track of our argument today in an audio recording, which means that we would like you to state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so that those listening to the public audio recording will be able to keep track of who's making which argument. There's also a little button in the lectern you can raise or lower it at your convenience to match your height. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Amy Lawler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Crystal Olson, in this appeal. Ms. Olson was convicted of both felony and gross misdemeanor fourth-degree assault of a peace officer. And I'd like to begin with the question of whether the state proved all of the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. Unlike in many cases where the lawfulness of police conduct is purely a pretrial question, here, it is an element of the offense. To prove appellant's guilt of assault in the fourth degree against a peace officer, the state had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt under 609.2231 subdivision 1A that the peace officer was effecting a lawful arrest or executing any other duty imposed by law. The state has made two arguments as to why the police were effecting a lawful arrest or executing any other duty imposed by law: that the police were acting under the emergency aid exception to the warrant requirement, and that Olson was not arrested until after police witnessed the crime of Olson kicking Sergeant Rowden. I'd like to address each of these, keeping in mind the standards of review.
Ms. Lawler, before you go into the first one about emergency aid, I guess I feel like the arguments were focused on the propriety of the officer's response to her movement toward her mouth, I think. Is the case law really that specific? I mean, isn't it enough that the officers responded to a dispatch and went to the scene? You know, they were dispatched to go to this incident and they arrived. Isn't that enough?
Well, there's certainly—
or is there case law saying that, no, we have to look at specifically what the officers did while they were at the scene?
There's not a lot of case law in any of this. There's not generally a question about the lawfulness of the police conduct. But in terms of the question about what the police motivation was at that time and essentially when in the sequence of events the assault occurs, this is only a crime if she assaults a police officer while they are effecting the lawful arrest or executing any other duty imposed by law. So in this case, the question turns on at the moment of the alleged assault, which occurred after she was handcuffed, whether the police were executing a lawful arrest or any other duty imposed by law. Because at the moment that she was handcuffed then, that was the preceding event that then everything else followed. All of the alleged conduct on the part of Ms. Olson, including any alleged kick or stomp, and any alleged actions in which she pushed her handcuffed hands behind her back against Rowden's wrist, occurred after this arrest.
So I take it there's no case law. I mean, a common sense answer to that question could be they were on duty, they had clocked in for the day, and they were working, and there was a dispatch, and they responded to the dispatch. There's no case law saying that's not enough to prove the requisite duty.
No, there's not any case law specifically on the question of kind of when in that moment it changes. I don't think there's any dispute that, of course, police are allowed to go to the scene of a call. There's no dispute there. There's no dispute that they're still executing a duty imposed by law when they arrive on the scene and begin talking to her. But that changes when they arrest her.
What about before then? So correct me if I'm wrong on my understanding of the facts. There's a call from the church. The custodian sees someone in a few different locations, mm-hmm. appears to be behaving extremely oddly. Mm-hmm. Shirt up over her head. She's walking around with socks on. Then she shows up and she's walking without her socks. She's mumbling. She's stuttering. The police show up. These are officers who are not just trained police officers, but who are familiar with individuals who are suffering from mental health issues or under the influence of drugs, and they perceive her to be under the influence of drugs. She has something in her hand, and she quickly tries to put that, whatever it is, in her mouth. Am I correct on the facts?
There's a little bit of, you're not entirely correct, but you're very close. There is a difference, I think, at two key areas. Right. One is they weren't certain whether or not she was also in the throes of a mental health crisis. They suspected she was under the influence. The officers also testified they suspected she might be undergoing a mental health crisis.
Was there anything else yes, where I was wrong?
The second issue is essentially when she began to raise her hand up. She had a closed fist. She testified that they'd asked for her identification. None of the officers testified as to whether they asked for her identification, so hers was the only testimony on that point. She raises her closed fist up, and as it reaches her shoulder, they grab her, the three of them grab her and handcuff her. So it wasn't rapid. There was no testimony that it was rapid, and there was no testimony that it reached her mouth.
Yes. Officers did testify they perceived that she was moving it towards her mouth.
Yes.
Officers, I assume most officers are aware that people overdose when it's not an uncommon thing in law enforcement for someone to overdose when they're under the influence of drugs already and they're trying to hide drugs from the police and they think at the moment, improvidently, that the best way to hide the drugs is to just throw them into their mouth and consume them. Even if it is not for a belief that she's committed a crime, but in order to protect her, isn't grabbing her at that moment a police duty that would be imposed by law?
No. And this really goes to the heart of the question of the emergency aid exception, which is what the state here has invoked with the act of the police grabbing her and immediately handcuffing her. And that turns on the question of what the emergency aid exception allows. The state's essentially advocating for what you just summarized, a very broad interpretation of the emergency aid exception, such that when any police officer arrives on the scene, sees someone who might be intoxicated, has an unknown object that they think might be a drug or might be headed toward their mouth, that that's enough to arrest them.
Well, not necessarily enough to arrest them, because there's a dispute about when the arrest took place. Enough to grab her arm to try to restrain her out of concern for her. You're saying that's...
Well, I think I have two responses. Okay. One is that I think that what the state is trying to do here is draw a line in time between the seizure and the arrest that occurred at the time of handcuffing. That is not what any of the officers testified. They testified that they grabbed and handcuffed. There was no period in which there was some sort of seizure, anything akin to a Terry stop, nothing like that. They grabbed and handcuffed.
But couldn't handcuffing be part of rendering aid in a circumstance like this particularly?
I guess hypothetically it could be, but then we go to the question of what the emergency aid exception requires. And this is where the state has failed to meet its burden, as an element of the offense, that this is a type of police action that would fall under the emergency aid exception and satisfy this element. And the reply brief cites the non-precedential Cadwell decision, which has a nice summary of all the case law, the published case law in Minnesota, that essentially lays out what you need to have to really invoke that emergency aid exception. And none of it was present here. There was nothing in the record that would indicate that Ms. Olson was, one, unable to communicate or non-responsive, or two, that there was any emergency need to protect life. And the examples that have been cited in the past, especially the Reese decision and his progeny, are situations where they were truly life-threatening. a 911 call because someone is afraid of a gun, for example, and the police have to rush in and secure that firearm because the woman and her baby are afraid. And this is an objective test, and that's important. Under Lemieux and Reese, the police have to objectively be motivated by the need to render aid. And in that case, it was a life-threatening situation. And that is what the case law has tended to focus on, is the risk to life and the immediate need to protect life. Here, the state...
What if the officers simply suspected... let's say the officers aren't concerned about her life. They're concerned that she's going to destroy evidence. They see someone they believe is under the influence of drugs, reasonably would suspect that what she's got in her hand are also drugs. And they're concerned that out of law enforcement, not out of a need to protect her, or a combination of the two, that if she puts those drugs in her mouth, the evidence will be gone. Do the officers have the authority at that point to grab her arm to prevent her from ingesting those pills and in under the auspices of preventing the destruction of evidence?
I think only in a situation in which the officers believe a crime has been committed and therefore that there would be evidence that would be needed to be seized for protection. Here, all of the officers testified they did not believe she was committing a crime. They had not seen any evidence of a crime. They didn't believe it was a crime. And they all testified that they didn't know what was in her hand.
Didn't they testify to what they suspected?
They testified to what they suspected.
So why is that not enough to grab her hand to prevent her from destroying the evidence?
Because under the standards for a warrantless seizure of a person, you're still, and in particular in this case, something more akin to a Terry stop or a pat search, you still have to believe that the individual is committing a crime. And then there would be an additional question of whether you believe they were armed or dangerous if we reached the level of the Terry stop. But even still in the minimum of the seizure, you'd have to believe that a crime was being committed.
Assume you're standing on a bridge with a suspect. The officers are standing with someone they've encountered. They have reason to believe that the individual, they're not sure, but they have reason to believe the individual has a handful of illegal drugs in his or her hand. And the individual reaches back and the officers suspect that the individual is about to throw whatever is in his or her hand over the bridge into the water. Do the officers have a justification then to grasp the arm of the individual to prevent what the officers suspect may be the destruction of evidence without more?
Certainly not under the emergency aid exception, as there's no aid being.
Right,
but
exactly.
Separate and distinct from that, no, I don't believe that that the case law would indicate that under those circumstances, specifically in the context of proving the element of a duty imposed by law or a lawful arrest, that the police could show that there was that it would be lawful to arrest or that it is a duty imposed by law.
So preventing the destruction of evidence of a crime that the officers suspect would not be enough.
I don't believe so under these circumstances, under the context of the fourth-degree assault on a peace officer. I don't know if there would be any other context in another criminal situation, but in this case, it's an element. And so I think the standard for the element and the proof of the element is higher. And I also think that certainly Minnesota has drawn lines about what we can do to preserve evidence that there's a risk of it being destroyed, even if there's a risk that a person might injure themselves in the course of destruction. It's not at all under the same, the legal question is slightly different. In State v. Brown, that was the case of the individual who shoved a baggie full of cocaine into his rectum, and the police wanted, one, to preserve the evidence of the cocaine, and two, they argued there was a risk to him that if it burst, he would likely die. And even in that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court said essentially that that's not enough, that the risk to the person from undergoing an invasive procedure that they didn't consent to.
Well, there's a difference between the state forcing someone to undergo a medical procedure and an officer grabbing someone's arm to prevent either destruction of evidence or prevent the individual from ingesting the evidence. I'm trying to imagine a totally different set of circumstances where the officer sees and suspects exactly what the officers saw and suspected here, and your client throws the object into her mouth and then suffers a seizure from a drug overdose. I'm just trying to imagine what the civil suit would look like when the officer testifies, yeah, I suspected that she might have drugs. I saw that she was under the influence, but I didn't do anything to stop her from ingesting the drugs.
Well, and I think I have two responses. One is that I don't think that the question of a civil suit would be the defining characteristic here, although certainly I think that the civil suit might have been on the minds of the police officers when these charges were filed or might have informed their activity at the time. It's still the state's burden to prove that they were acting as an element of the offense, that it was a lawful arrest or acting to execute a duty imposed by law. And I think it is particularly important here that...
I'm imagining a lawsuit where the allegation is you failed to exercise reasonable care in your duties under the law.
Yes. And the state law is actually very clear about what is required under that emergency aid exception. If the person is able to decline care, if they're able to interact, if they're able to say hello, if they're able to say, no, I don't need an ambulance... there is no duty under the emergency aid exception. And it might be that that seems odd to us, that we as citizens might want to rush in and save someone who might be doing something where there is a risk of something that might be self-destructive. That's not what the law says. The law creates a much, much more stringent analysis as to a warrantless seizure and, in this case, arrest.
So if I understand your argument, taking it through to its logical conclusion, an officer is standing on a roof with someone who has said, I'm perfectly of sound mind, but I'm going to throw myself off this building. And the officer does not have the authority to stop the person by physically restraining the individual from leaping to his death.
I think that might be a different question about whether the individual has just announced their intent to commit a crime or has begun to
take... No crime.
Well,
suicide's not a crime in Minnesota.
So putting aside that, any risk that they're putting aside, that they are taking, announcing a crime, putting that aside, that their only thing is that they're announcing an intent to harm themselves, yes. There is no duty for officers to force people to make the best choices or the safest choices.
And the officer would violate that person's constitutional rights, Fourth Amendment rights, by grabbing the individual and restraining the individual.
I don't know if that would be true under the context of fourth-degree assault on a peace officer, which is where this would arise, or the general questions about what an officer might do if someone is actively engaged in a suicidal threat, and particularly, I think, in that context, then, a question of whether a civil commitment proceeding would be appropriate and whether then you're arresting someone under a separate statute regarding mental illness. That is a separate question from here, which is, there was no question. She was responsive. She was able to say she didn't need help. There was no risk that she was going to commit suicide. They just handcuffed her. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. Before I get into my argument, I just want to respond to a couple of statements that were made with respect to what we know and what the facts are in this case. We have the testimony from Deputy Rowden, Deputy Watts, and Sergeant Matthews, and the janitor. But we also have the benefit of the audio recording. So, appellant argues the assault occurred after she was handcuffed. The evidence doesn't support that claim. Defendant testified that she was asked for an ID. I'll talk about that. That is not supported by the evidence. And that the deputies immediately put her in handcuffs. So here's what we, at 3:40, we've got a deputy, we can hear him radioing into dispatch, asking, is Crystal Olson on probation? They, as soon as all of the deputies testified, as soon as the T-shirt came down, they knew who she was. There's nothing on the recording where anybody ever asks for identification. They already know who she is.
Small town, right?
Pipestone, yep. So then at 3:48, I believe it's Deputy Rowden, just because his voice is the loudest and it's his recording. Got something in your hand. Then 351 to 354. Oh, whatever that is, give it to us. Come on, don't do this. 407, I think it's Rowden asks, what's going on? And at 409, appellant responds, nothing. Then at 410, one of the deputies starts yelling, drop it. And then Rowden says, drop it, don't put it in your mouth. At 420 to 424, you hear officers saying, stop, stop fighting, stop fighting. And then at 426, I believe this is consistent with Sergeant Matthews, who said he was the one who told them to put her in handcuffs. At 426, you hear him say, put her in cuffs. So this all starts quite a bit before she's put into handcuffs. Sergeant Matthews testified he didn't know when the stomp had happened. He was told by Deputy Rowden that his foot had been stomped on during the scuffle. He learns of it after she's been put in handcuffs. But Sergeant Rowden's testimony was that she stomped on his foot during the scuffle. So I think she stomped on the foot while they were in a scuffle. It's really not super important here, but I think there's this belief that they just immediately grabbed her and handcuffed her, and that she was defending herself from this unreasonable assault by the officers. And that is simply not the case. It's clear, all three of the officers testify, that she's exhibiting indicia of being under the influence of a controlled substance. And her behavior is disoriented. She appears to be disoriented. She's not responsive. Yes, she does, at the 409 mark, respond nothing. But prior to that time, they're asking her, Crystal, what's going on? What's going on? And she's largely non-responsive to that. Deputy Rowden testified that she was saying some things, but he just couldn't make out what she was saying. He referred to it, I believe, as mumbling. So that's not responsive. You have somebody who's non-responsive, who is exhibiting multiple indicators of a central nervous system stimulant, and then they specifically ask her, what does she have in her hand? So yes, did they seize her when they grabbed her arms? Yes, they seized her. But in the context, they wanted to know what was in her hand. And I was thinking of something, you know, it's been framed that the officers were worried about themselves, they're worried about Crystal Olson, but I had forgotten until this morning, there's the janitor here as well. So are we just supposed to, when the deputies ask what's going on and she says nothing, are they just supposed to walk away and leave this janitor to deal with Crystal Olson, who we then see later on in the squad video, can be extremely violent? No, they have a duty to find out what's going on, and given the indicia of impairment that they see, when they see that she's got something in her hand and they ask her what it is and she doesn't respond, she makes the motion to go to her mouth. There is nothing out of the ordinary here. This only goes to count two, which is the gross misdemeanor. There is no muddied evidence about when the count one, the felony assault, took place. The district court judge instructed the jury that count one, the felony, requires demonstrable harm. That took place when defendant deliberately sat on Sergeant Rowden's wrist. That took place after she'd already been arrested. Now, you can say it was an unlawful arrest, but as Berg and State v. Wick make clear, you don't have the right to resist an unlawful search or seizure. You can resist when you've been subjected to a personal attack. And that's what the judge instructed the jury on pages 235 and 236 of the transcript.
To what extent, if any, should we be concerned, or let me put it a different way, if we have concerns about the level of force the officers used during this altercation and apprehension, does it bear on our analysis in this appeal?
No. This is just a straight sufficiency of the evidence challenge. The standard of review that this court applies is you view all the evidence in a light most favorable to the verdict. The officers testified why they did what they did, and we have the benefit here of the squad video. You can see when she's escorted out to the squad car, then she comes into view of the rear passenger of the of Sergeant
Well,
Rowden's pickup.
I was kind of referring to the response about having his hand set on, you know, the punch in the arm, punching her, and then grabbing her by the hair to remove her from the squad car. Seems like a bit of... one might not look at the level of force and see all of it as completely necessary.
Well, again, this is a sufficiency of the evidence challenge.
I understand. That's why I was asking.
The jury looked at it, and they found that the officers acted appropriately, and they found that they disregarded. They found that the state had disproved at least one element of the self-defense claim. So there's evidence in the record to support the jury's verdict on both counts. There's evidence in the record that supports the state disproving self-defense. So this is not an appellate jury, as you're well aware of. You don't just reweigh the evidence, and that's effectively what you've been asked to do. With respect to the
first... referring back to that, was there testimony by an officer denying punching her in the face?
There's never any... That question was never posed.
There was evidence, though, that she had self-inflicted when she got to the jail.
Yes.
No harm, is that correct?
Yes, Deputy Rowden testified that... there's a limited period of time during which somebody can be placed into a restraint chair, and eventually she had to be removed from the restraint chair and she was put into a cell. He testified he was watching her through a closed circuit camera and he saw her striking her head on the door. But, Your Honor, with respect to your question, I don't believe the question was ever asked of an officer, did you punch her in the face? Deputy Rowden testified that he did punch her in the arm, and he testified in his training as an experience, it's a strike because she was sitting on his hand and he was hoping to get her off of his wrist.
And just to be clear, did the defendant testify that she was punched in the face?
I don't recall that she ever testified she was punched in the face. She did testify that her two fingers were, one or two of her fingers were broken during the scuffle when the police officer were trying to find out what was in her hand. But that was clearly belied by the squad video evidence where when her hands are behind her, if in fact she has two broken fingers, you sure can't tell it from the way she's scooting back and forth across the back seat of that squad car when she would have been sitting on her fingers. Just briefly on the first issue, asking the district to reverse the district court based on evidence that wasn't presented to the district court at the time, there isn't any case law on that, but I just think under Florence, as I argued, that's not a real strong argument. But if this court gets to reversing on the sufficiency of the evidence, it's moot. If this court affirms on the sufficiency of the evidence, the probable cause challenge goes away.
I think appellant's argument, as I understand it, and of course Ms. Lawler can clarify for me, is not that the district court erred at the time of the motion to dismiss for probable cause, but rather that the Berg principle should also apply on sufficiency review at the time, I guess, now. That's my understanding. Do you have, if I'm correct, do you have any response to that argument?
Well, there was no objection to the jury instructions. So the jury instructions are pretty straightforward. State had to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant intentionally assaulted and inflicted demonstrable bodily harm on Sergeant Rowden while he was effecting a lawful arrest or executing any other duty imposed by law. So the only way that this court can get around that would be by exercising supervisory powers, and those, I believe, are reserved to the Supreme Court. This is an error-correcting court. So that would be something that the Supreme Court could take up under Berg. But even looking at the facts in Berg, the Supreme Court did not find that the officer's conduct in that case was so egregious as to warrant reversal. The facts in that case are far worse than what's alleged here. If there are no other questions, I'll cede the rest of my time.
I have a question about the phrase in the statute. The definition of peace officer means a person who is licensed and, quote, and I'll insert numbers, one, effecting a lawful arrest, or two, executing any other duty imposed by law. I asked, on the second part of that, I asked Ms. Lawler some questions about whether that's necessarily such a high bar or such a stringent test as it requires conduct, you know, such as the emergency aid, such as conduct authorized by the emergency aid exception. I'm not clear about the state's position on that issue. I guess maybe you could just summarize. I mean, why is the evidence here sufficient to satisfy either the first or the second?
Well,
why is the evidence sufficient to satisfy either the first or the second, therefore to demonstrate that a peace officer was assaulted?
Well, certainly with respect to count one, which is the felony assault that occurred in the back of the squad car, by that time, again, she'd already been placed under arrest, so you can't resist even an unlawful search and seizure. You can resist an unlawful attack against the person, but that instruction was given to the jury, and the jury found in favor of the state. So the second assault, the count one, the felony one, which is really the meat of the matter here, the appellant was under arrest, and they were attempting to effect that and get her to jail. On the first one, State versus Lemieux, 726 Northwest 2nd, 783, lays out the three-part test for the emergency aid. And I just can't see that officers here did not act appropriately under the circumstances. Now, I suppose you could just say that Deputy Rowden, when he says, don't put that in your mouth, that was some kind of performative statement, that wasn't really what was going on. But as you listen to it and you listen to the tone of voice that the officers are using, they're trying to be reasonable with Ms. Olson up until the point when they think she's trying to put something in her mouth and an officer says, don't put that in your mouth. And they tell her, stop. So Could you find that these officers didn't act appropriately? Boy, that would be a dangerous road to go down.
Is Lemieux a case involving this statute, the statute about fourth degree assault of a peace officer?
No, that's just that looks.
It's a Fourth Amendment case.
Yep. Okay. Yep. It's can you enter a home without a warrant on the suspected burglary's been committed?
Counselor, to be clear on the second issue, so to speak, the sentencing issue. You're agreeing that she should have only been sentenced on the felony and that she should not have been sentenced on the gross misdemeanor, which I think is in the record, but it's not real clear that you agree that she shouldn't be sentenced on the two misdemeanors.
Yeah, we concede that she should have received the one felony sentence and that she got a 366-day sentence on the gross misdemeanor. You can get a maximum of 365 days. So we agree that she was sentenced inappropriately on the gross misdemeanor.
I'm not clear on whether, so in her reply brief, appellant has, accepting your concession, of course, I think has two other small issues on pages 12 and 13 of the reply brief, and I'm not sure if you have any, if you have a position on, it seems like there's some loose ends there, and I'm wondering if you have any surrebuttal argument about those issues.
I see my time is up. Can I briefly respond?
You certainly may.
Thank you. I don't disagree with I probably misspoke that it should not disturb the underlying verdict, so that if if count one later goes away, that count two could be adjudicated and sentenced.
Okay.
Your position is it should remain as a non-adjudicated verdict then?
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you. I'd first like to clarify some facts, and then
and again, if you could first just remind the record again of your name, so we have a recording of it.
My apologies, Your Honor. Amy Lawler, Assistant State Public Defender.
Thank you.
On the question of facts, I think it's important. There are two questions here that I think are important to clarify. One is that Ms. Olson did testify that the officer, Rowden, punched her in the eye at pages 171 to 72, 185 to 86. Exhibit 8 shows the black eye. And to Judge Kirk's question, there was no testimony that she ever self-inflicted an injury on her eye. There had been some testimony about whether she was kicking or banging any part of her body against the cell wall. There was no testimony that she, for example, punched herself in the eye or in some way injured only her eye. The second factual thing to clarify is the question of when she was handcuffed, because the officer's testimony was actually unequivocal that she was handcuffed solely because of the thing that she was bringing to her mouth, they thought, and not because she had kicked or in any way assaulted Rowden. That testimony is at page 86. Where he was asked why was she handcuffed, and he said because she just tried to eat something, that and she was exhibiting multiple signs that she was in distress. He again reiterated that testimony, again on pages 88 and 89, that she was handcuffed before any alleged assault took place. On the question of the standard of review, which I think is particularly important here because the standard of review is in Ms. Olson's favor. Under Reese, this court does conduct a de novo review of the district court's application of an exception to the warrant requirement, and it also, in a question of a warrantless arrest, independently reviews the facts to determine the reasonableness of the conduct of police. And that matters particularly in this case because, unlike the vast majority of cases, the lawfulness of the police conduct is an element of the offense. If the police arrest of Ms. Olson was not lawful, then there was no fourth-degree assault. And I think that the state muddles the issue a bit by essentially addressing it as an omnibus issue or solely as an issue of whether or not the district court erred in allowing the evidence in. That's not enough. It was an element of the jury that the jury had to decide. The question, of course, though, and the thing that makes it a little different, is that the legal question of whether the police conduct was lawful or whether they were executing a lawful duty, that was never specifically posed to the jury in the context of instructing them as to what the lawful arrest or duty was. They skipped that part of the jigs. And so that de novo review by this court is particularly important in the question, in the context of the question of whether a warrantless arrest, whether there was some exception that would transform this into lawful duty on the part of the officers.
Can I take you to another hypothetical?
Yes.
Change the facts. A police officer comes upon someone who appears to be bleeding profusely. The officer believes this person is, I mean, it's a major artery that's been cut. I have to act. The individual says, I don't want your help, and begins to pass out. The officer then goes, places a tourniquet on the individual's leg and tries to apply pressure to stop the bleeding. An individual comes up, assaults the officer.
A third party
assaults the officer. Under your understanding of the law, I take it that that would not be assaulting a police officer in the course of the officer performing a lawful duty.
I would not agree with you. I do think that that would be a lawful duty on the part of the police officer and that the emergency aid exception would apply.
Right.
Because in that case, you mentioned, one, that it was the individual receiving the aid had passed out, which is a crucial question under Cadwell and in the analysis.
But immediately before passing out said, I don't want you to touch me.
Yes.
Stay away from me.
But once they've passed out, the rules change a bit.
Let's change my hypothetical.
Okay.
Not passed out, but is telling the officer verbally, I'm in my right frame of mind. I would rather bleed out here on the street than have you touch me. Don't touch me. Officer begins to apply the tourniquet anyway. Person who's offended by the officer stepping over this individual's right to die, grabs the officer and begins assaulting the officer?
So I think that there are two parts to that, and my time is short, so let me know if you need me to stop. But on the second part, I don't think that the third party coming into assault gets to make the choice about when or when not a person agrees to accept emergency aid. I don't think there's any case law in the state, certainly hasn't pointed to any case law.
But under your theory, the officer is not performing a lawful duty.
That's true, under the theory.
The crime could not be the felony assault on a police officer while performing a duty, under your theory.
Under my theory, only the person receiving the aid is the one that essentially has the ability to consent to aid or not, and, of course, to change consent. A third party coming in wouldn't have that knowledge. They wouldn't have the ability to read the mind and make that decision.
They don't have to read the mind under my hypothetical. They heard the individual.
Yes, but they don't know essentially what that individual is thinking or whether that individual might change their mind. But I also think that the state certainly hasn't cited any case law on the emergency aid exception that allows us under these circumstances where the individual is not in any apparent distress, certainly not engaged in any sort of conduct that they all agree no one thinks she is, that her life is in danger. And that's, I think, the bright line here, maybe in all of your hypotheticals, that just don't apply here. No one testified that it was a life-threatening situation. No one testified that the emergency aid exception could be invoked from someone who is not in immediate danger of death and who declines help. And that's why we ask this court to reverse.
Judge Ross, may I ask my own hypothetical?
Yes, you certainly may.
So, Ms. Lawler, let's assume there's a public festival, let's say a county fair, and a police officer is on patrol, just on foot patrol, just walking through the public event, and it's very peaceable. Everything is fine, so the officer's not making an arrest. And out of the blue, somebody blindsides him or her by running from the back and hitting, kicking, striking, or something like that. Is that person within the definition of a peace officer under 609.223(1) sub 1?
I believe so. Assuming that they were actually on the clock, engaging in some sort of parole, foot patrol, then yes. I think it would be a different situation if this were an off-duty police officer attending the fair as a civilian.
Yeah, uniformed, on duty. Yes. But then why doesn't that same rationale apply to the officers in this case?
Because in this case, the assault allegedly occurred after they had arrested her, after they'd handcuffed her.
Well, the second in time, I believe, the count one, but the first in time, count two, I mean, isn't it true that was before any arrest?
No, and that was the pages I started with, the pages 86 to 89 of Rowden's testimony, which are unilaterally agreed to by all testimony, that they grabbed, they handcuffed, and then the kick happened. And that was, there were multiple clarifications of that throughout pages 86 to 89. The handcuffing occurred before the kicking. And I think that's very important because the state essentially raises the prospect that maybe it happened at the same time or maybe the handcuffing happened after and asks you to inquire as to the audio and listen to that. But Rowden's own testimony was absolutely clear about the sequence. They grabbed, they handcuffed, then the kick occurred.
Okay.
So all of this is in the context of the law, whether the arrest was lawful and whether there is any exception under the emergency aid requirement for a warrantless arrest. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to both counsel for your briefing and your helpful argument today. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is not in recess, but we're going to take a momentary break to reconstitute the panel.